Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Steve Barry is our guest this morning. I was thrilled to track him down, one of the nicest, most humble guests I've ever had, and also one of the most successful. His name is on so many hit records, including actual number one hit records. It's really an astonishing list of great music. The whole program today, we did feature his stuff, and if you want to hear the whole program, head to WFMU.org/Michael, and you can hear all of the music that I played related to Steve Barry. This is a fantastic contrast to the interview I did with P.F. Sloan, Steve's former partner. It was about 2.5 years ago. I interviewed P.F. Sloan right before he passed away from cancer. No one knew he had cancer. I don't even know if he knew he had it when I interviewed him. I don't think he did. And he has a fantastic story, and I mean that quite literally. It's almost, there are some things in it that are hard to believe. In this interview with Steve directly refutes some of those things, just straight out says they aren't true. I think there's some things that P.F. Sloan said to me that I figured weren't true, like he talks to Beethoven all the time, but maybe he thinks he's talking to Beethoven. It's kind of complicated. But, you know, if you haven't heard my interview with P.F. Sloan, go to WFMU.org/Michael and listen, because it's really bigger than life. But it was great to hear the other, more grounded side of the story, what happened to them, what happened to their partnership, and the amazing thing is that Steve Barry had even greater success after his partnership was over. And I think part of the legend of P.F. Sloan is that he self-perpetuated was that he did the lion's share of the work. But it's very clear here that Steve had his own amazing career, completely separate from P.F. Sloan. Some great music, great guy, like I said, totally humble, great music business stories here. A huge part of why 60s pop is so great, and 70s pop. Here he is, my interview with Steve Barry. All right, there is Meet Me Tonight, Little Girl from Philip and Stephanie. You can hear Steve Barry laughing in the background. I take it it's been a while since you've heard that one.
Yeah, it's been a long time. That was basically done at the time that the Beatles were starting to, you know, to kind of take over the whole business. And my partner, Phil Sloan, and I, we've been writing primarily surf songs, you know, for Jan and Dean, and we sang background vocals on Little Old Lady from Pasadena and a bunch of their records, and you know, we were writing the surf music that was popular at that time. And when the Beatles started to happen, you know, we decided, well, let's do some demos in a in a kind of English kind of a mood. We sang it ourselves, and we even put on a bit of an English accent, and it wound up coming out as a single, because I don't know, Lou Adler, who was my mentor and the head of the label, Dunhill Records, that we were on, felt that, you know, it could be a hit. So they put it out as a single.
Yeah, it's just part of an amazing story. You have been a writer, a record producer, a record executive, a lot of things throughout in the music business. I believe you were born in Brooklyn, 1942. Why did your family move to California?
My dad moved to California for work, you know, to try to get a job out here, even though, you know, at the time, you know, I was very upset about it. It meant leaving, you know, friends and leaving the Brooklyn Dodgers on my team, who fortunately moved out here a couple of years after I did. But that was the reason that we moved out here.
And was there music in your house? Were your folks musical? Did they have tons of records?
Always music in the house. My mom, you know, played the piano. I grew up on songs, basically the Great American Songbook, you know, the Cole Porters and the Irving Berlins and Rodgers and Harts. Though, you know, we always sang those songs around the house. Everybody in the family sang. So much like many of the songwriters of the Bill Building era, you know, we all had that kind of in our family. Yeah. And so, you know, kind of just stuck with you.
While still a teenager, you recorded a few solo singles on Rona Records. This would be like 1961, 62. A few records with Carol Connors from the Teddy Bears. How did you break into show business once you got to California?
I actually, my goal was to be a disc jockey. You know, when I first heard Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers, even though Elvis was impressive for me, but two in particular out of, you know, I guess it was 1956, 1957. You know, I loved those records so much. I felt like, God, I want to be part of that, and I want to be making music like that. So I started to take, not lessons, but I learned a few chords on a ukulele and then a four-string guitar, and started writing some songs. Eventually, I put some demos together on a tape and sent them around, and I wound up it's like a small publishing deal. And that was kind of the start of it. And then I started writing with various other people.
You make it sound so easy. I mean, I know there was a lot more indie labels. There was a lot more opportunity. But was it fairly easy to do what you just said?
Well, it wasn't that it was easy. It was just that I fell into it. You know, a lot of it is timing and luck. You know, I guess some of the songs I was writing were fairly good. What happened was I met Carol Connors, who I knew. We went to the same high school, Fairfax High School, and, you know, she had already had a number one record with the Teddy Bears, you know, To Know Him Is to Love Him. So we did a couple of demos, and the owner of the record store that I worked at, which was Nordy's Records, it was right next to the high school, he took a demo and took it to an independent promotion man, or a guy that worked at a promotion in Los Angeles. His name was Russ Regan. And Russ Regan liked this record, and he said, I'm going to put it out on my own little label, independent label. And so Russ Regan, who turned out to be a guy who, you know, was the president of Uni Records and signed Neil Diamond and Elton John, but at this time he was just the promotion guy. So he put this record out. We started to get airplay on the big station in town, which was KFWB, and Lou Adler, who was then running Screen Gems music, heard it, and also a Colpix label. He heard it and he liked it, and he picked it up and wanted to put it out. By the time he was ready to put it out, the record had already peaked in Los Angeles. So he said, you know, do you have any other songs? And I played him some other songs, and he said, you know, I'd like to sign you as a songwriter. So, you know, at that point, getting paid $50 a week for basically what was my hobby sounded real good.
Yeah. You kind of alluded to this earlier. For guys your age, born in 42, I would imagine, you know, you talked about the Great American Songbook, and it's funny how, you know, we think of 60s pop as kind of the greatest era for pop music and for the development of pop music. But it's funny that you didn't have 60s pop to influence yourself because you were creating it. So that all of that amazing pop music was created by guys who grew up on the American Songbook.
Pretty much so. You know, when I do, I teach courses now on music, and you know, I kind of break it up in various different periods. Naturally, there were the songs of the songbook that a lot of the young writers, Carol King, you know, Jerry Goffin and Carol King, and Man and Wild, and you know, all those young writers of the Brill Building were writing all the hits for mostly black artists during the early parts of the 60s, all grew up on the same kinds of music. And there was that period of growth, certainly from 55, 56, up until, you know, about 1960, you had, you know, more experimental kind of R&B, the real, you know, the coming of age of rock and roll music. And then it kind of softened up from the 60s up until the Beatles came along. You know, it got a little bit more tuneful, and we're trying to say a little bit more in the songs that we were writing, other than, you know, I'm Walking, Yes Indeed, you know, than those early R&B rock and roll records, which were fantastic because it was the beat. And then from 1964 on, once the Beatles showed up, everything changed, and, you know, and nothing has been the same ever since. It just keeps changing.
Yeah. So you mentioned Lou Adler. I believe it was Lou's idea to team you up with P.F. Sloan. What was your first impression of Phil Sloan?
I was in awe of his ability to write melody because I was very limited. You know, I had hundreds of ideas and titles and ideas for songs, and Lou thought were great, but I only knew these three or four chords, although Neil Diamond made a great career only using a few chords. But, you know, he was a lot better than I was. So anyway, I was impressed with what Phil could do. He was a very talented singer as well. And so when we started writing some songs together, it just clicked.
Yeah. So I find it fascinating when you do the research about you. You know, there are records that are by Philip and Stefan, the Rally Packs, the Wildcats, the Street Cleaners, the Rincon Surfside Band, the Lifeguards, and more. And these are all just basically the two of you guys under different names, right?
Right. You know, I mean, these were just demos that we were writing for other people. And there were times when we couldn't get records done, you know, by the acts that we wanted to have record them. And because Lou was, you know, a very powerful individual in the record industry, if we felt something had a chance of being a hit, he said, hell, let's put it out and see what happens. And so we did that with a few records. And that's how we started the grassroots. Started that way, you know, it's basically Sloan and myself.
Just another one of those fake bands. Were you guys still only making $50 a week? I mean, did you get paid as the artist on those records, or was it just part of the deal?
Well, no, it would. If any of those records would have become a big hit record, you know, we would have dealt with it at that point. At this point, we're just looking to get songs played and get songs on the radio. So, you know, as each year went on, you know, we started to get a little bit more money. And then once we started to hit with, like Where Were You When I Needed You and then Eve of Destruction and whatever, then it kind of all just blew up so quickly. You know, it's just that all of a sudden we were not only getting our advances, but we were making royalties as well.
I think the biggest of those sort of fake bands was the Fantastic Baggies. I looked up the Fantastic Baggies on Wikipedia, and the first two sentences were something like, the Fantastic Baggies were an American surf band created by P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry. The group released several unsuccessful singles. And I thought, like, well, I love this band, and I love their records, and it's funny how it just gets reduced to these two sentences. You know, there's some fantastic records there.
Well, the one record, the Tell 'Em I'm Surfing, did, I think that made the national charts. It was did very well here in Los Angeles, but, you know, we were just never, well, let's face it, basically what we were doing is what everybody else was doing at that time, which was trying to imitate the Beach Boys. So, and some of the songs that we wrote were done by acts like Bruce and Terry. We wrote a song called Summer Means Fun, and they had a top 40, top 50 chart record, national chart record with that. So we were writing these surf songs, and Jan and Dean were doing a lot of our songs as well. We kept trying, but to be honest with you, you know, you had neither one of us had ever been surfing in our lives. I came from New York, and, you know, sometimes I listen to the original demo that we did on Summer Means Fun, and I'm saying Summer Means Fun. I'm sounding like I've got my New York accent. The last place I would be from would be Malibu. But, that's what we were doing at the time. We're just trying to write songs for various different artists.
Yeah. Lou Adler forms, I think he founded Dunhill Records, and he brought you guys over. And the amount of work in this small period of time is truly, it's unlike anything. I mean, I really can't think of any other artist that did this much. In the next, I'm going to say 2.5 or 3 years, you had songs cut by The Accents, Connie Stevens, Ann Margaret, Betty Everett, Dick Dale, Bruce and Terry, The Ripcords, Shelley Fabre, Fetty and the Dreamers, Penny Arcade, Herman's, Paul Revere, The Kingsmen, Johnny Rivers, Barry McGuire, Searchers, Tommy Rowe, The Thomas Group, Sandy Nelson, The Ventures, Hugo Montenegro and his orchestra, Gary Lewis, K-Star, The Hondells, Mamas and the Papas, etc. I mean, it's a really, really big list. You must have written easily a couple hundred songs. What was the work ethic like? How did you get that many songs written in such a short time?
Well, first of all, we would meet, it's a structure that you form. We met every day, not always in the office that we had, because we felt we were more productive when we would write in Phil Sloan's dining room in his house. It was like a kitchenette because it had a great echo sound. So the guitar, everything always sounded bigger in there. And we would just sit there and come up with ideas. I had a book, you know, filled with different titles and whatever. And then we'd sit down and just pick a title. And then Lou would tell us, you know, so-and-so, Herman's need a song. And, why don't you guys try to write something for them? And then I'll tell you, you know, it's like a strange story about that. We met with the people from MGM, and they were doing this film with Herman's Hermits, and they said, you know, we'd like to do something, because this was just coming slightly after the Beatles had Hard Day's Night. And so I remember this producer telling us, you know, if you could write something, you know, kind of off kilter, like it's a Hard Day's Night, something, you know, with a kind of a weird title, we'd like that. And I said, I have this title for kind of a positive, negative kind of idea about a girl called, you know, She's a Must to Avoid. And they said, oh, that's great. That's exactly what we want. So we wrote that song as well as a few others. And we went into the studio. We cut the songs with them. And then they apparently that was going to be the name of the movie. So they screened it. And when they screened it, the reaction was so bad to it that they came back and they said, we can't use that song. We have to change it. And we said, why? They said, because it makes it too easy for reviewers to say this movie is a must to avoid. So even though it came out as a single and became, you know, a hit, they wound up changing the name of it to Hold On. But, you know, from something that they loved, it was something that they couldn't use. But anyway, it was Lou Adler, really, that, you know, that he knew Mickey most, who was the producer of the Hermits. And he got us into, you know, to work on that project.
Yeah. I had P.F. Sloan on this show just really a few months before he passed away. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's a really unusual guy, to say the least. There was sort of this idea, you know, he's sort of remembered as this mad genius, and your contributions sometimes, I think, are minimized. And, you know, looking at your whole picture, and we'll talk about this later, you really had more success after your, and I think people don't know that, after you and Phil stopped working together. But tell me, when you were still working together, what was the division of labor? How did the songs get written? Who did what?
I pretty much came up with the titles for the most part and most of the lyrics. Phil would come up with, you know, the melodies. And sometimes I would, you know, a song like Where Were You When I Needed You, which was one of our first, you know, kind of hits, you know, like a top 40 record with the Grassroots. That was a song I pretty much wrote by myself. I don't know if Phil added anything to that. And on the other hand, Eva Destruction came about when I gave Phil a lyric of a song called something like Nothing Changes. And in it, I had the lines, even if you left here for 4 days in space, you know, when I come back, it'd be the same old place. And it starts off being about a guy that and a girl that, you know, just keep having differences all the time and nothing changes. They try to get things better. And the second verse went off to a little bit of a political thing, which I was never into. And so I gave that to Phil and I said, hey, work on this. And the next morning he came back with the song Eva Destruction, which was totally, you know, other than those two lines of mine, it was absolutely nothing like anything I wrote. And at that point, it was my belief, honestly, that something changed about him that, you know, after writing that particular song. You know, unfortunately, tragically, Phil got into drugs at a time when a lot of other people were out here. People feeling that, you know, in order to write like the Beatles and whatever, you know, everybody, you know, was trying to see if dropping acid or whatever, you know, made you, you know, would let you write better or whatever. All I know is from that point on, his dream was to be the next Bob Dylan. He wanted to be the next, you know, the next guy, the next big importance, you know, singer-songwriter. And didn't want to write for pop songs, the kind of songs that we were writing anymore. So, you know, I said, well, okay, if that's what you want to do, then, you know, fine. You know, I'll why don't we do an album? You keep writing those songs, and the songs we write together. We came up with the name P.F. Sloan to try to make it look like it was different than the same guys that are writing Tell 'Em I'm Surfing, because we felt like if Eva Destruction, if people see it's written by the guys that are writing all these surf songs and bubblegum songs, you know, it's not going to be taken seriously. So we came up with the idea of having him be, you know, the sole writer on those things, even though we shared the royalties. And that was the start of it. But at that point, you know, the partnership that we had, which was so great up until that point, it just all changed. He started disappearing. He didn't show up when we were doing, you know, our production and our mixes. And he just, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, it just totally changed. And got very, very, I mean, it was just so strange. I just could not make sense of what he was saying or what he wanted to do. And he seemed to be very frustrated. And so, you know, eventually he just kind of disappeared. And, you know, so I told him I was going to go in, I'll finish up the grassroots sessions that we're working on. And I said, but, you know, we'll still give both of us credits. But, you know, you got to get yourself together. And we tried to really get him help at times. And I think at one point he did go in to get some help. But he changed from that point on, and he just wanted to go a different direction. And my love was just making, you know, pop songs. And I love just making music. So I just got more into the production end of things. I couldn't write as much anymore because when things were changing so quickly that at one point our company became so hot when the Mamas and Papas, you know, when we signed them, and that story was amazing also because they were signed because Barry McGuire, who had recorded Eve of Destruction, brought them in to sing background on his record. And then we heard them and we called Lou and said, you got to come down and hear these people that Barry brought in. They had been sleeping in their car all night. They had no money, nothing. Couldn't even afford guitar strings. And so Lou came down, heard them, and he immediately signed them. And then, you know, this was before Phil kind of went off on his own. We were still working together at that point. So, you know, things were just changing so quickly. And then eventually Dunhill Records was sold to ABC Records, you know, which was the big parent company from the East Coast, and they were now in charge. And at that point, Lou, who, you know, like made a lot of money, decided he wanted to leave. He didn't like to work under, you know, under the umbrella of anybody else. So he went off to start Ode Records. And I said, you know, Lou, I want to go with you. I don't want to stay here. And he said, no, he says, you're under contract. You got to stay here. But he said, but you'll take over my job. You're going to become the head of A&R for the label. And that's how, you know, so all of a sudden now, I don't have time to write songs anymore. I'm running a record label as an A&R man.
Well, let me back you up just a little bit because I want to talk about some of these records. And it was amazing that besides writing all these records, you were also producing a lot of these records and I assume making demos of a lot of these songs that you wrote or all the songs that you wrote. So I want to ask you about specific records and feel free to just say a sentence or two about the artist or about the sessions or something about each one. Tell me about working with Jan and Dean.
That was one of the first things we did when we signed with Lou because we were writing some surf songs with them. And Jan, who was really a very brilliant, you know, producer, very musically gifted, except that he wasn't a great singer, and Dean was like, you know, pretty good, but they weren't great singers, and they felt that they would like us to sing backgrounds, or at least Jan did. So Jan just brought us into the studio. It was one of the first things we did. He was working on Little Old Lady from Pasadena at the time, and, you know, we did the backgrounds on that. So we became very friendly with them, and, you know, Jan liked a bunch of the songs that we did. Also, when I don't know if you know about the Tammy show that in 1964 when there was this big closed circuit television show called the Tammy Show, where it was the first time I think ever that American acts played with English acts. The Rolling Stones were on the show, and the Beach Boys and James Brown. It was an incredible show, and we were asked to write the theme song for that movie. And so what we did was we wrote the song, and we also sang some backgrounds on the show as well.
Tell me about Barry McGuire, Eve of Destruction, went to number one. Did you guys know when you wrote it? Did you know when you heard him cut it that it was going to be a giant hit? And were you sort of trying to write a song to express what the generation of kids was feeling, or were you just trying to have a hit, or both?
Well, we decided, because we were, you know, like songwriters for hire, the idea was to try to write songs for, for whoever was looking for songs. The problem was, you know, in writing those kind of songs, even though we wound up getting a lot of songs that the Turtles recorded, you know, for artists at that point, it was becoming more important for an artist because of Bob Dylan that an artist be considered someone that wrote and sang their own songs, that it was, you know, this was just who they were, and this is, you know, what they were, this was what they were feeling and where they were coming from. So when Even Destruction was written, that was really Phil. You know, I got to say that was his idea, his song, and mostly his thoughts. He only took two lines of mine in that song. So none of us at the time thought we would even be able to get it played. And so we were recording the album with Barry McGuire, and this is when Barry brought in the Mamas and Papas, and Luke started to work with them, and we were left alone to work with Barry. And we had just started really getting into the production end of things, thanks to Lou. So we're working on this record, and, you know, we know what the A side of this record's going to be. I don't remember which one of our songs it was, but we needed a B side. And Lou said, why don't you do that, you know, teach Barry that Even Destruction thing, we'll throw that on the B side of the record. So we say fine. And that night we run the song down for him. We already had our demo track, and he sang the lead, reading it from the lines that we gave him, at times not getting it right. At times we'd be punching in, you know, to get various different lines right. And he's looking, he's going, decent world, you know, he's stretching out things. And we said, just learn it and then take it home tonight. And then tomorrow we'll come in and we'll do an actual vocal on it. And then we'll add instruments and we'll finish it up. And this is the true story. Now, I bring in this tape, you know, and all we had was reel to reel tape. The next morning I bring it into the office. I was the first one, you know, in. And Jay Lasker was the president of Dunhill Records at the time. Came by my office, said, what are you playing? I said, that's just the thing we're doing for Barry McGuire for the B side of the record. And he said, let me hear it. Let me take it into my office and listen to it. Well, all I know is he takes it in. About 3 or 4 hours later, Lou Adler comes into the office, and I hear screaming and yelling and carrying on. What had happened was Jay gave the tape to one of our promotion men. The promotion man brought it over to the big number one station in town to see what they thought of it, if they would play a record, you know, protesting everything like that, you know, and we thought it would be a problem. And what happened was they put it right on the air, unbeknownst to us. They put on this demo. They carded it and put it on. And within an hour, it became the number one most requested record on the radio. We didn't even know about it until Lou came in. He said, I just heard... You know, how did it get there? I said, I don't know. I just gave a tape to Jay Lasker. So, make a long story short, without a final mix, with a rough vocal, we learned very early that, you know, if something is right and the timing is right and whatever, you know, it could be a hit without even finishing it, because we never really finished that record. And that's the demo vocal that he put on there. I mean, you know, we barely spent any time, and we thought it was just a B-side. And before we know it, I mean, we asked this radio station, we said, you know, it's not finished. We'll finish it and get you a finished record. And they said, fine, we'll, you know, they said, but don't bother. We can't stop playing this. It's getting more requests than the Beatles. So that was the beginning.
That's amazing. You mentioned the Turtles. You Baby was probably your biggest hit with them. Tell me about this group, The Imagination, Summer in New York. It's one of those records of yours that I love. I think Bones Howe, who was a guest on this show, produced the record. Is that a real band, or is that just you guys?
No, that was just me. Bones, who, you know, was like one of my mentors. Bones was an amazing producer. And, you know, was an engineer for us and, you know, taught me so much. And one day he said, you know, why don't you record something, you know, as a group? And I said, I don't know. Phil was always the much better singer. You know, I sound too, you know, bubblegummy, you know. And I did have this song, you know, called Summer in New York. And he said, I love that. You know, let's record that. So, you know, that was his idea. And I just sang on it and he produced it.
It's a lovely record. Let's talk about Secret Agent Man Johnny Rivers. Again, it's one of these records that's been covered a billion times. You know,
right.
I assume that was written to order?
Basically, yes. I mean, what happened was, again, thanks to Lou Adler. Lou was recording and producing Johnny Rivers. I think he was managing him at the time. And managed to get a situation where Johnny was going to sing the title song of this English television show. It was a big hit in England called Danger Man. And it had been on the air there for a couple of years. And as a summer replacement, it was going to be here on CBS for about, I don't know, just for the summer, for whatever, for 10 weeks or whatever. And they wanted a theme song called Danger Man. So at the time, to be honest with you, when Lou said, you know, can you write a theme song, it came to me because I had to write the lyric called Danger Man. And I said, oh, Lou, you know, that's embarrassing. You know, we're starting to write some great songs and everything. And, you know, we don't want to do this. He says, hey, you know, if they're willing to pay, you know, X amount of money. I said, that we'll get right on it. So so all we wrote was a verse and a chorus. And the chorus was, look out, danger, man, because that was the name of the show. At the last minute, CBS called and said, we're going to change the title of the show to Secret Agent Man. Could you change it? So we went in with Johnny, and Johnny, you know, I mean, instead of Look Out, Danger Man, we punched in Secret Agent Man, based, and the whole thing came on the idea. My thinking is, because I couldn't think of what to write about Secret Agent Man, but Lou said, you know, he says, look, think of James Bond. The reason that this is happening now is because this James Bond, and I was a tremendous fan of the James Bond movies. So I basically wrote it thinking about that. I wrote the lyrics anyway. Phil came up with that great guitar figure. All we wrote was one verse and that one little chorus. So the show went on the air, and after the summer it went off, and that was the end of it. We thought we were through with that. But for season two, the show was so popular, it came back for a second season. And when it did, Johnny Rivers called one day, called me at the office, and he said, you know, everywhere I go, people are asking me to sing Secret Agent Man. He said, I can only sing the one verse. He says, can you write me a second and third verse? And I said, well, would you put it on the B side of a record and at least make a record? He says, yeah, you got it. You know, I'll tell Lou I want to record it. And I said, great. So, you know, we wrote the rest of it. Johnny recorded it. And again, you know, I mean, who knew? It was such a silly idea. And yet, you know, it just clicked.
Yeah, it really did. I saw that you guys, you and Phil, produced the album Drums A Go-Go from Hal Blaine. It's just one of the million little projects you guys worked on. Tell me about working with those Wrecking Crew guys like Hal Blaine, who really so important. You know, I would say 80% of all those records that I've mentioned, they play on, right?
Let me tell you something. Those guys, those musicians, and, you know, I mean, there was a large group of them, but until we went into the studio with them, for the first demos that we recorded, I didn't think, you know, I had no vision in my mind that anything that I was involved with could ever sound as good as they made it sound. I mean, Lou, again, put us with these guys that I guess he had worked with. And when we went in to do our first demos, we had three songs. Two of them were kind of surfy, poppy songs, and one of them was kind of an R&B song that we had in mind maybe for somebody like the Ronettes or something like that. Lou said, all right, go in and demo the songs. All we had was on, you know, I had the lyrics and Phil would play it on guitar. And he said, you know, I'll get you some musicians and you'll go in and cut three songs on, but you got to do it in 3 hours. But he says, with these guys, it'll be no problem. So, I mean, we go into the studio and the first time we ever went in with any songs to demo, we wind up with Hal Blaine playing drums, Joe Osborne playing bass, Larry Neckel playing piano, and I think Glenn Campbell played guitar along with Phil and those things. And they're doing this for like $50, you know, a man as demos. And for the demo singer, we sang the two pop songs, but we needed a female demo singer. And Phil gets us Darlene Love, who at the time I had no idea who she was. The only thing is that when she opened her mouth and sang our song, you know, and I heard it with that music, I said, you know, I may be able to have hits in this business because these people are amazing. They're the ones that are making things hits. And they were spectacular. The album we did with Hal, the Drums A Go-Go, was Jay Lasker's idea. He was the president of the company. He was like an older record guy. And he had all these ideas of putting these albums together for ideas of doing Disney songs and, you know, various different things. We were, you know, I was, my brain was, you know, moving ahead towards rock and roll, but you know, he thought that he could sell records with those things. And working with Hal was such a joy. We loved doing it because he's one of the funniest guys. He's one of the greatest musicians, you know, you could ever work with.
We've had him on the show. He's still a riot, and he's just full of great stories. Steve Barry is our guest today, and you're so humble. It's amazing considering all these amazing records that you worked on. Is there a song or a record that you guys thought would be a hit that wasn't, or one that you never thought would have been a hit that was?
Well, to be honest with you, more songs, you know, some the songs that became hits were mostly songs that we didn't know to become hits. Some of my favorite songs that we wrote, you know, I'm not going to be able to think of the titles now, I'm sure, but, you know, some of my favorite things where I felt like, well, I love that lyric or whatever, you know, never happened or you know, or we didn't even get them recorded. So, you know, Lou Adler, you know, there was one song, I'm not sure which one it was, and I remember we recorded a demo of one of our songs, again, early in our career, and I thought it was, you know, I thought it was great. I thought it could be a hit, and I told Lou at one point, I said, you know, Lou was trying to get it with some people. He said, nobody seems to connect with it. So I said, maybe if we put on, you know, a harmonica for the solo, or, you know, I embellish the demo, maybe put like an organ on. And he said to me, he said, you know something? You can't polish a turd. That was his line. And you know, and in essence, what he was saying is that the song is the key to everything. And if people don't relate to the song, no matter what you do around it, it's probably not going to change things. Although some records become hits because they're just so well-crafted and sound so different. But it always came down to the song. And I learned that early with Even Destruction because I realized, wow, this is like a, you know, a half-assed demo with, you know, with a vocal not even as good as it could have been if Barry really had time to work with it. It's just that he had such a, you know, an urgency to his voice that thing just worked. But yeah, so you know, a lot of the songs that we wrote just you know, didn't become, you know, what I was hoping they would become. I never really had a chance to continue writing because when Adler left Dunhill and I was put in charge, I realized, well, if I'm going to be, you know, signing artists now to the label, and the first thing they told me to do was go out and sign some artists. Because I said to Lou, I said, you know, I don't know how to, you know, do this. You know, I know how to write songs and, you know, we're following you. He says, go out. You know, good act when you're here. And so, you know, I got lucky. The first act I saw, the first two acts I signed was Steppenwolf, and the second one was Three Dog Night. So all of a sudden, you know, we're this really, you know, hot label, and you know, I'm this major A&R guy, but I can't write songs and take them to these artists and say, you know, this is a great song, because, you know, I can't be promoting my own songs to people. So I figured, you know, I got to kind of just get into the production thing. I'll find other songs and work it that way.
Well, let me ask you, in those crazy days, you're still in your early 20s when everything we've talked about so far has happened. What did you do with your money? I mean, did you buy a house? Did you buy sports cars? What was your thing?
No, I was never into that. You know, I mean, eventually, yes, I bought a house, but, you know, I was so tied up in making records and so in love with what I was doing that, you know, I was almost in the studio. You know, I would have to go into the office early and I would have to meet various people, especially when at one point when we took over and were overseeing ABC records, and all of a sudden now I'm dealing with, you know, with B.B. King and some of the acts that they had, Ray Charles and other acts. You know, I had to find material for all of these people and producers and whatever. You know, it was just almost overbearing, but I loved what I was doing and I was having fun while I was doing it. I never thought about the money. I never got into that. You know, I mean, you know, you had perks where if you traveled first class and they would, you know, you could, they would give you a car every 2 years. You get a, you know, a new car from the company. All those things were fantastic. But it was really, To be honest with you, you know, if you have a hit record, and every time I would have a record that would go to like number one, and everybody, we'd have a party, and you know, everybody would you know, and we'd have cake and whatever, and everybody's so excited, and I'm thinking to myself, Jesus, what do we have for a follow up? I'm already thinking ahead, you know, yeah. What are we going to do, you know, for the next single? Is the next single going to be as good as that? So
it's fascinating. I mean, you do. Your reputation is not at all of I mean, I didn't read a bad word about you, which is, you know, which is for a record guy, that's I mean, I'm sure someone, I could dig up something, but really your reputation was so positive. You were working, as you said, with the Grassroots, and, you know, I should also point out that you produced those first couple P.F. Sloan records. You are the, you know, the sole credited producer, and those are fantastic records. What about Phil's claim that mobsters made him sign away his publishing forever and ever? I mean, is that, from your point of view, did that really happen? Do you know?
No, there's an awful lot, you know, that I don't know the stories he came up with. You know, we knew each other so well. You know, I also, you know, I know he told stories that he met Elvis Presley, and, you know, he never met Elvis Presley. We knew that. Elvis never gave him a guitar. You know, I think those were all things to try to embellish this image that he was trying to create for himself.
Did he sign away the publishing?
No, of course not. He still has, you know, I mean, what happened was, because he stopped writing songs, you know, at one point, the Jay Lasker, who was the president of the company, told him, you know, we were trying to get him to go in and, you know, his mom also, who we were friendly with, you know, was telling us, you know, we got to try to help him. You know, he's kind of losing his way. He's hanging out with bad people. You know, he's getting into this drug scene. And so we tried to get him to go in to, you know, to rehab, which I think he did a couple of times. But Jay Lasker, what he did was he said, look, if you don't start writing songs again, I'm going to put a hold on your royalties. And so for quite a while, I think that's what happened. I spoke to Phil, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago. You know, we were talking, and I was asking him about some songs that we had, because somebody wanted to change some of the lines on something. And I just called him. I said, you know, how do you feel about that? You know, it'll, you know, put it in the movie. I said, and it'll give us a, you know, like a good sync fee. We'll probably get like $20,000-$30,000. He says, well, I don't get any money from my royalties anymore. I said, that can't be. Our royalties now are, you know, it's more than it's ever been. Why wouldn't you get royalties? He says, well, they don't give me any. Well, apparently he signed something, you know, with the company that said that, you know, if he doesn't, you know, continue to write, that they can hold back his royalties. So I actually put him in touch with an attorney, and the attorney went to ABC, and ABC eventually he got all those back royalties. So and then he started to get his royalties again at the end. But there were never any mobsters or anything like that. That's silly. Although on the East Coast, I know that there were a lot of stories, you know, within the confines of the Brill Building, you know, where mobs, you know, mobs.
Morris Levy and all those guys, yeah.
Morris. I tell Morris the story all the time.
Well, it's very interesting because, I mean, P.F. Sloan told me, you know, on this show that they showed him, you know, pictures of dismembered bodies and said, this is going to be your whole family if you don't. And he said that he lived very, like, a pauper's life because he never got this money. It's quite interesting.
Part of that is true, because he wasn't getting his royalties. I couldn't believe that, you know.
But he didn't say at the end he got it all back, which is such a huge part of the story to leave out.
Oh, yes, he got all of his royalties. In fact, you know, I'm now dealing with the attorney that, you know, that takes care of his estate, because, you know, we've got, you know, quite a bit of money coming in on some of our songs. So
I'll bet you do.
He eventually, you know, got all that money.
All right, let's talk about the next chapter, like you, because the next chapter is huge. You start working for ABC. One of the first things, you get a number one hit producing Tommy Rowe's Dizzy, and I notice the arrangement is by Jimmy Haskell. Tell me about arrangers and how that worked. Would you give them a demo? How would they work up the arrangement?
Well, with Tommy, first of all, when I became the vice president of A&R for ABC Dunne when the companies merged, Tommy was one artist I was fascinated with because I was a Buddy Holly freak. And to me, you know, Tommy's record of Sheila and some of those early records, he always reminded me of Buddy Holly.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So I thought I'd love to make some records with him. And he had this one song, Dizzy. And then a couple of others. The two others that we had were the ones I thought were great. We went into the studio, and what we would do is just go in with chord sheets, with just an outline, and then the musicians, it would come to life in the studio. Sometimes it would, sometimes it wouldn't. Most of the times it would because of the great musicians we had. And so we would cut, you know, a basic rhythm track, and then we decide, you know, okay, do I want to add horns to this, you know, or do I want to add strings, whatever? And then I would hire an arranger, most of the time Jimmy Haskell, because I loved working with him. And I would just kind of, I'd play the track and the vocal on there, and then he had this little tape recorder, and I would just kind of sing along with where I felt strings should come in and kind of what they would play. And then he would just make magic from the terrible things I was humming, you know, and to these great strings. The funny thing is that on Disney, I thought it was too bubblegummy and it wasn't the one I liked. So there again, you know, Tommy kept saying, you know, I think we should, that's the kind of record my fans like. I said, okay. I said, let me get Haskell. Let me see if we can do something to make it really stand out. Jimmy wrote those great string arrangement. And, you know, that was probably the biggest single I ever had. I think we sold 5 million copies of that record.
It sounds, fresh.
So there you go. You know, with my so-called great ears, I never heard that one as a hit until the strings were on. Then I said, you know, maybe this could really happen.
1969, people I think don't know that you produced Mama Cass's solo records, which are fantastic sounding records. Who found the song Make Your Own Kind of Music? Who brought that in?
That was brought in, sent to me by, you know, the Brill Building songwriters, talk about them, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. I think we did three or four of their songs. I was always a tremendous fan. You know, they were kind of idols to me because Sloan and I started at Screen Gems, Screen Gems was part of Alden Music and Alden Music that Donnie Kirsten started in New York. It's all part of that fantastic Brill Building period where, you know, 50% of all the hits, you know, coming out on record at that time were coming out of the Brill Building by all those great songwriters that were writing there. So I was always a big fan, naturally, of Carole King's and Man and Wiles and whatever. And so Cass, when I met with Cass, I said, you know, what are you looking to do? And you know, she says, I don't know. She said, you know, I just like to sound. I want to make records that sound different than what I was doing with the Mamas and Papas. So I said, what about something? When I spoke to Barry Mann, and he said, what kind of things you're looking for? You know, I said something, you know, from Cass because she's kind of a free spirit or whatever. You know, something that would just say, you know, hey. You know, I'm gonna now do things my way or whatever. And that's all I said. And then a couple of days later, he said, what about something called Make Your Own Kind of Music? And he did the demo, and I said, boy, it's perfect. So, you know, we went in and recorded that. And, you know, it obviously became a big hit.
One of the things I noticed about Mama Cass is that two Mama Cass albums come out in 1 year. I mean, that kind of, you know, I mean, just a few years later, people like Fleetwood Mac were taking, you know, 5 years to get a snare sound or whatever, but like two albums in 1 year, because is that just because you're working with arrangers and great songwriters and these guys who can knock out a song or two or three every session?
Well, it wasn't my preferred way of doing things, but the Jay Lasker, who is now president of ABC Dunhill, you know, they, when you become a corporation and all of a sudden now you know, you've got to meet certain numbers and budgets, and you know, it was stuff that drove me crazy. I try to avoid it as much as possible. But you know, they always wanted more records by the artists that, you know, that meant billing for them. So it, you know, we were always pushing Steppenwolf and Three Dog Night and whatever to give us more product. I wasn't part of that. Now, the reason you probably don't hear, you know, people, you know, talk about me, you know, the way they may talk about record labels is because the one understanding I had was, you know, I just talked to everybody about creative, what they're going to do creatively. I never talked. I didn't even know what anybody's deal was or anything like that, because we had attorneys and we had people that did the budgets and everything. I was just involved creatively, and I always was very supportive of the artists because, you know, to me they were our lifeblood, and I always tried to make them happy. Eventually, when I left ABC Records and I went with, I was offered a job to be the vice president of A&R at Capitol Records at the time, but I wanted to be Warner Brothers, just go to Warner Brothers just to be part of that A&R staff, because I just felt that Warner Brothers was such a artist oriented label that I just, and I loved the people there, I was very friendly with them, and, you know, that I felt like that was where I would feel, you know, best being, and the, you know, I turned out to be, you know, I was very happy over there.
You worked with Del Shannon, the great Del Shannon, on a few singles. You worked with such a range of folks, Rosie Grier and Lancelot Link. And these are folks that you produce. You produced the a group of Monkees. One of my favorite singles, "Don't Pull Your Love" by Hamilton, Joe Frank, and Reynolds. What a record that is! 1971, sort of one of the last few Wrecking Crew records. I assume that's one where everybody sat in the recording studio and said, okay, this song is going to be a giant hit. Is that right?
Well, to be honest with you, it was a song. I had signed two writers. I had signed Dennis Lambert and Brian Potter to our label because I always felt whenever I heard good songwriters, you know, I wanted to get them, you know, on the label because we always needed songs for various artists. You know, Three Dog Night didn't write, and I was always looking for songs for them, and the Grassroots didn't really write. A lot, and a lot of our artists didn't. So Lambert and Potter wrote this song, and I thought it would be a smash for the Grassroots. They don't remember the fact that I played it for them, and they didn't like it. They didn't want to do it. They thought it was, you know, too bubblegummy. So I told them, I said, you know, I said I'm going to find an act to do this record. And I said, this is a hit record, especially, you know, with that title, and especially, you know, it's just so catchy and so hooky. So, you know, we found this group that we felt were real good, and we went in, you know, to make that record. We put it out at the same time. I remember traveling with our promotion man, Barry Gross, and we went out with that and Two Divided by Love, which was a Grassroots record at the time. And we went out to all these various record stations across the country. He thought it'd be cool if I went out there, and you know, we tried to get both of those records on the air. We got the Grassroots record on pretty easily. It was a little bit of a fight for the Hamilton Show, Frank and Reynolds, but eventually, you know, the way the business was back there, where you start records in various different areas and it builds, you know, not like it is today. And it started wherever it got played, it just took off immediately.
Yeah, it's such a great record. It's one of those records that still gets played a lot. You know, when people think of the classic 70s records, it's funny, there were records that were bigger hits that you don't hear anymore, but for some reason, that's one of those records that you still hear.
Yeah.
All the time. So it's funny how the Grassroots went from being a fake group to actually becoming a real group, and they had some huge hits. I mean, they dominated, like Midnight Confession and Sooner or Later. We heard I Get So Excited earlier. Those were just, again, you do sort of have this knack for slightly bubblegummy, super sticky pop hook records. The Four Tops, Ain't No Woman Like the One I Got, you co-produced. Bo Donaldson, The Haywoods, Billy Don't Be a Hero, 1974, you produced. Right. That was a huge record. I mean, I was 10 years old when that came out. That was a giant, giant record. People don't know you produced Kinky Friedman. And then you had these three huge hit records. I think they were... you had Welcome Back by John Sebastian. You co-produced it. It was number one. You had the theme from SWAT. You co-produced with Michael O'Martin, number one. And Top Five, the Happy Days song by Pratt and McLean. Those are three giant hit records. I mean, that's crazy, you know? you like, the chapters of your career are just going on and on.
Yeah, well, you know, things happen. like that. You know, I'll tell you the quick story of the theme from SWAT again. You know, now this was a record. You know, my young son at the time had a friend, and they would play. They watched the television show SWAT, and they loved it. And they would go around running around. You know, bang bang, and then they would da 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 da. They loved that theme. And so one day, my son said, "You know, hey, Dad, you know, can you get me that record?" And I said, "All right, I know Barry DeVorzon who wrote it. You know, let me see. I'll call him." So when I called him, and you know, he said, "You know, hey," he said, "why don't you make a record of it? Because you know, I don't have a label or anything." So I was about to leave ABC, and so at the end of the session, we just did an arrangement on it, real quickly. And, you know, it came out great with great musicians, Jay Graydon and Omardian and, you know, all these great musicians. And I did the track on it, and everybody liked it so much. They said, you know, why don't you finish it up, put some strings and horns on it. So we did that, and the record really started in the dance clubs. So we did a disco version, you know, a stretched out, you know, 5, 6, 7 minute version of it. And it started to really explode in the clubs. And because all of a sudden that thing became a hit, you know, everybody in the business that had a television show started calling me to record, you know, their songs. The first person was when I made my move to Warner Brothers. You know, I had met with John Sebastian, who I loved, and, you know, was thrilled to work with him. And so he had told me, he'd, you know, written a song for this new Welcome Back Carter show. And you know, would I put, you know, can I make it into a record? He had already laid out the foundation of that. So all I did was kind of produce it as a record and stretch it out. But yeah, that became a hit. And then they came to us. I got a call from Gary Marshall, who, I didn't want to do any more of those things because I was wanting to get into, you know, producing more folk rock kinds of things and more, you know, important kind of album kind of artists. But, you know, Gary Marshall was just, you know, I couldn't resist him. So we made a record of that, and that became a hit as well. Those are the first couple of things that we did at, you know, at Warner Brothers Records. And then Alan O'Day, who was, you know, who I knew because he was somebody that was always pitching me songs, came to me with this song called Undercover Angel. And I said, geez, you know, that's a smash idea. So I wound up, you know, producing that record for him.
Also, number one hit, 1977. And that's a lot of number one hits. I mean, do you think you get respected as? I mean, you know, you've had a hand in so many hit records. And like I said earlier, it's absolutely true that you had more success after P.F. Sloan than with P.F. Sloan. Don't you think that's true?
Oh yeah, there's no question about it because you know that only lasted a couple of years.
Yeah.
I, you know, to this day, you know, to be honest with you, I always. You know, wonder what it would have been like had he just, you know, kept on the straight, you know, and narrow the way we were and we kept writing for other people. I think we would have written more hits because I think we were getting better and better at it.
Yeah.
You know, my dream was to be the next Goffin and King or the next Man in Wheel. And, you know, Phil's dream apparently was to be the next Bob Dylan or the next John Lennon. And so, you know, at that point, there's really no, you know, reason to go on. But I always felt, you know, I wish we would have because I really enjoyed writing, you know, the way we were writing. But, you know, as it turned out, you know, I just always had an ear for, you know, for hit songs. I started as someone that wanted to be a disc jockey. And, you know, so my big thing was always, you know, I could just tell the first time I heard some songs if, you know, that I would say, geez, that could be a hit. So.
It is amazing. You know, that's a really interesting idea of what if you guys had stayed together. And it is kind of, we'll never know, but it's you can sort of only imagine. Yeah, yeah. I think your fingerprints are all over so many records that clearly there's, you know, no matter how humble you are, there's, you know, there's the thing in common is you. So you have to kind of give yourself some credit for them. You worked with tons of people. You worked in Motown in the 1980s, which was kind of a weird time for them, but you worked with some of their huge artists and kind of rejiggering their back catalog. You did some, in 1989, you had a top 10 single with Animotion. You did more producing, some management. And then now you said you're teaching, and I guess during all this, you managed to raise a family. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have two two grandsons now. I have two sons, two grandsons, and one of my youngest grandson, whose name is Matt Barry, currently is he's like into, you know, the EDM music, you know, and he's got, you know, record out there now, you know, or I don't know, we don't call them records anymore, but, you know, he's got music out there now that he's got like 50, 60,000, you know, hits on, and he's started to really make a name for himself. So, in fact, I'm working, you know, with him on a couple of things, but he's, you know, it's a whole different world to me, that the, you know, the EDM thing, but
yeah. Well, I'm sure that for you managing your back catalog, just the publishing rights, like you said, just people from movies or television or ads or whatever. I mean, that must be almost a full-time job if you want it to be.
Well, you know, I do as much as I can, you know, pitch some things along the way. I'm very, very happy with, you know, doing this, these lectures that I do. I spend hours a day editing various clips together of artists that I'm doing a course now over at the Skirball Center here in L.A., where they have a big exhibition of all Leonard Bernstein's memorabilia. And I've been doing lectures on Leonard Bernstein music and West Side Story. I'm drawing like huge crowds for these things. So people, you know, seem to be into it. And I grew up, you know, a Broadway baby. I grew up in New York and seeing a lot of Broadway shows. So I know that music very well. And I do courses on the Great American Songbook, and that's been fun. And I really enjoy, you know, just talking about the music, all the great music that, you know, that I grew up with.
Well, Steve Barry, this has been so fun. I mean, this just every great song has a great story behind it, and there's so many great songs connected to you. Thanks for taking a minute to visit with us. How about we hear Summer in New York, since it is summer in New York right now?
Yes.
Anything I need to know? Any more do we need to know about this record?
No, other than it was my reflections of what it was like for the summers that I did spend there, you know, Bones Howell's production on it, which I thought was real good. My singing, not so good, but whatever.
I love this record. Well, thanks so much for visiting us, and thanks for all the great records.
Sure. Okay, well, thank you.
Summer in New York, the hours seem so much longer. Yeah.